Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. If you want to know what goes on behind the scenes at The Simpsons, Mike Reiss is the guy to ask. He spent 30 years as a writer, producer, and showrunner. He shares his secrets in a book called Springfield Confidential: Jokes, Secrets, and Outright Lies from a Lifetime Writing for The Simpsons. Before moving to Springfield, Mike was working on It's Gary Shandling Show.
It was funny. The Shandling Show was the next to the lowest rated show on TV. It was number 99 out of 100. The only thing lower than us was the Tracy Ullman Show that had 1 minute Simpsons cartoons on it.
Yeah.
So I was on a 3 month break from the next to the lowest show on TV and was just looking for work, looking for some money. And The Simpsons came along, and when they called me, I said, "Why are you calling me?" And they said, "Because everyone else has turned this job down." And it was a funny thing. It's very hard for any of us, even me, to remember the mindset of that time where it wasn't just going to be a failed show, but it seemed to be career suicide. I know one of our writers, Jay Kogan, was the son of a professional comedy writer, and his father begged him not to work on The Simpsons. So it was risky for all involved. And certainly very, very, you know, I got to give credit to Fox. It was extra risky for them because they had to buy 13 episodes without ever seeing 10 seconds of footage.
Yeah, because of all the lead time involved in the animation. Was there anything that you learned from your experience working on It's Gary Shandling Show that you were able to apply to your work on The Simpsons?
Gary Shandling Show was all about breaking the rules.
Yes.
And always being ever conscious that, you know, you were doing a TV show and don't ever do anything you've seen before. That was all part of writing for Gary Shandling Show. And Gary was an extremely demanding writer. He was literally impossible to please. And it's because he was such a great gag writer. It was hard to write a joke up to his standards. And those are the standards I think we brought to The Simpsons. Just let's make sure every single joke is the very best joke we can write. And if it takes 2 hours to get this line, fine. And then we're on to the next line. And the process just starts all over again.
You say that the people who make animated comedies often think that if a joke doesn't work, they can save it in the animation. But on The Simpsons, you say that if a joke doesn't work, there's nothing that can save it, not even the animation. So how do you and the other writers know if a particular joke will work?
It's a completely democratic process. I call it a laughocracy. You know, when we're rewriting the scripts, there's 6, 7, 8 writers sitting in the room, and we go, "We need a joke here." Everyone just starts throwing out jokes. And if something makes more than half of us laugh, it goes in the script. And then we have a table reading where the cast reads the script out loud. And again, a line has to get a laugh from everybody who's sitting there listening to it. And 2 months later, we see the show in rough animated form. And we have about 40 people watching the show. And a joke has to get a laugh again. It always has to get a result. Nobody could ever say, "I know this is funny," even though it's not getting a laugh. That never works at the show. And sometimes they're right. You know, my biggest regrets over the years are jokes I almost killed because I thought, "This is not funny." And then we put it in the script and it got a huge laugh. Or somebody will even say, "Oh, that's my favorite joke." And I feel terrible about that.
Can you give me an example?
Yes. Any Simpsons junkie will know the joke where Homer is about to lose his dental plan, and he finds out Lisa needs braces.
Yes.
And so Jay Kogan, Wally Walidarsky wrote this script where for 3 pages, the script is just, "We need a dental plan. Lisa needs braces. We need a dental plan. Lisa needs braces," over and over. And I didn't think it was funny, and my partner, Al Jean, didn't think it was funny, and we're about to cut it. And Jay and Wally, the writer, said, "You got to give this a shot. We think this is really going to work." And we read it out loud with the cast, and oh my God, it not only killed then, but it is. You know the joke, the fans, it's one of the favorite jokes in Simpsons history, and we couldn't see it. Al and I did not see it on the page.
It's basically the same deal, except we get a free keg of beer for our meeting.
Yay! Yeah!
In exchange for that, we have to give up our dental plan.
So long, dental plan!
Dental plan.
Lisa needs braces.
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 Bullseye!
Thanks a lot, Carl. Now I've lost my train of thought.
Dental plan.
Lisa needs braces.
Dental plan.
Lisa needs braces.
At a table read, can you even judge a visual joke?
The system may be deeply flawed, but it's our system, which is, you know, we read the dialogue and that gets a fair hearing, but we'll just read out stage directions. We'll read, you know, a three-paragraph description of an itchy and scratchy cartoon, and somehow that will get a laugh or it won't get a laugh. It seems the work is a fair way to judge even visual material.
That's amazing. You identify four seminal episodes of The Simpsons, and one of them is called Moaning Lisa. It's from the first season, sixth episode, I believe. Can you tell me a bit about this episode and why it's such an important episode in the history of the show?
Sure. Al Jean and I had written our first script. This is first season of the show, and we wrote the one everyone remembers it, where the Simpsons are in family therapy and they're electrocuting each other.
Marvin Monroe, yeah.
Right.
Bart, how could you shock your little sister?
My finger slipped.
So did mine.
Big, broad slapstick scene. Yeah. Everybody loved it. So James L. Brooks comes to Al and me and he says, I've got the plot for your next episode. We said, great, what is it? And he goes, Lisa is sad. It didn't seem like a great use of the animated medium.
Yeah.
And the showrunners sort of mocked us, too. Sam Simon said, oh, Jim has always tried to do this. He wanted to do it on Taxi. No one would write it. And Matt Groening would just smirk. He'd go, oh, you're the guys who got stuck writing Lisa is Sad. But we write this episode, Lisa's depressed. And she meets Bleeding Gums Murphy, the jazz musician. And it's Marge has this epiphany that she is being a not great mother by trying to cheer Lisa up and tells her, if you want to be sad, you can be sad.
Lisa, I apologize to you. I was wrong. I take it all back. Always be yourself. You want to be sad, honey? Be sad. We'll write it out with you. And when you get finished feeling sad, we'll still be there. From now on, let me do the smiling for both of us.
Okay, Mom.
I said you could stop smiling, Lisa.
I feel like smiling.
So we did this episode. Even when it was done, I think nobody had much faith in it. And we put it on the air, and the public went nuts. They went nuts, and editorials were written about it. And everybody realized, oh, The Simpsons is not just a slapstick show. Oh, it's not just this naughty show for boys. It's got genuine heart. It can tackle complex emotional issues. It can look into the emotional lives of small children. So a very important episode. We're glad Jim Brooks is the boss because very often he makes us do things we never think are going to work.
Yeah, well, that's maybe one of the key things in a boss's position description, isn't it? Make my employees do things.
It is. I just read that great line the other day. The boss is not always right, but he's always the boss.
Yeah. Who is your favorite character to write for?
Oh, that's really easy. It's Homer, because Homer's just a comedy writer's dream. He has everything wrong with him, every comedy trope. He's fat and bald and stupid and lazy and angry and an alcoholic.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
Yeah! I'm pretty sure he embodies all seven deadly sins.
Yeah, I think you're right. And also, he smells, doesn't he?
He does smell, yeah. Fourth season, Homer walks into a pet shop, and the pet shop owner goes, oh, what is that terrible smell? And one of the writers, George Meyer, goes, oh, I guess Homer smells now, too.
Are there any rules of thumb for how to write Homer?
John Swartzwelder, who's written 60 episodes of The Simpsons, said, I write for Homer as if he's a big dog. And I thought, wow, he really locked into something. Homer is just pure emotion. No long-term memory. Everything is instant gratification. And, you know, has good dog qualities, too. I think loyalty and friendliness and just kind of continuous optimism.
Yeah, exactly. Combine that. Homer is a dog who suffers. I agree with you. Also, the seven deadly sins, I think that's key. He suffers from all of them equally, I think. Near the end of your book, you write about why The Simpsons has had such incredible staying power, and you say that it's based on two fundamental principles, family and folly. Can you unpack that for me?
Yeah, I was pretty happy with that. That came out pretty snappy. It was like a Simpsons episode. Right at the end, you go, oh, wait, he's not such an idiot. No matter what the Simpsons are, no matter how much they fight, no matter how much Homer strangles his child, they're a family. They love each other for all that. You know, there's some bond, even though they're all stuck in a small house, driving each other crazy. They're family. And that's eternal. And every animated sitcom that has ever succeeded is about a family. It's something kind of so obvious, nobody catches it. It's the Flintstones, the Jetsons, and King of the Hill, and Bob's Burgers, and American Dad. They're all family shows. So the show is about family, and then it's about folly. It's just, what is the world doing stupid these days that we can do an episode about? What can they do wrong in education? What can the police do wrong? You know, that's how we think of it. How The Simpsons is full of people being absolutely terrible at their jobs.
I'm peeing on the seat. Give me a raise. Now I'm returning to work without washing my hands. But it doesn't matter because I'm Homer Simpson. I don't need to do my work because someone else will do it for me. Do, do, do.
And as long as the world keeps getting messed up, we will keep doing episodes. And the proof of this is on November 8th, 2016, Donald Trump was elected president. And the next morning, Fox called us and said, you're picked up for two more years.
Yeah, and that was something, of course, that you got, that The Simpsons predicted like 20 years before it happened, right? But you weren't predicting it. You were just thinking of the most outlandish idea, and President Trump.
We said, what is the dumbest thing we could imagine America doing? That was our setup. Someone said, President Trump. We all laughed. And right before it went in the script, someone said, do you think that's too dumb?
As you know, we've inherited quite a budget crunch from President Trump.
How has The Simpsons changed television comedy and comedy in general?
Oh, that's one of my pet topics is, I won't say it's made TV better or worse, or it may have made it coarser, more vulgar, maybe. It certainly made that more acceptable. The one thing it did is change the pace of TV. Before The Simpsons came on, the number one show on TV was Cosby, and it was just Cosby sitting on a couch. Nothing ever happened. A lot happened right after they finished taping. Nothing happened on The Cosby Show. And the fastest-paced show on TV at the time was The Golden Girls. That was as irreverent as TV got, was a show with three corpses and a mummy shuffling around a two-bedroom condo. And that was, so The Simpsons came out and said, and our only mandate from Sam Simon was, let's jam it with stuff. Let's make it as fast as we can make it move. And since then, TV has picked up the pace. TV's trying a little harder. And you see shows now like Kimmy Schmidt or Brooklyn Nine-Nine where I go, wow, too fast for me. I can't quite follow what's going on.
Yeah. So comedian Hari Kondabolu has made a documentary called The Problem with Apu, in which he criticized the Quickie Mart character Apu as a poor representation of South Asians, and also had an issue with the fact that the character was voiced by a white actor, Hank Azaria. What's your take on Kondabolu's criticism?
We not only agree with all his points, but everything he said in the documentary, we said 3 years ago. We became aware of this as a problem. It was Hank Azaria was sort of at the forefront hearing from Indians. They didn't like the character. So we did an episode, again, 2 years before Harry's documentary, where Apu's nephew came to work at the Quickie Mart. The nephew was played by an Indian-American actor. And he said, you are an offensive stereotype. You sound like a white guy doing an Indian accent. We did a complete mea culpa, and then what nobody seems to have noticed, including Hari Kondabolu, is we retired Apu. You haven't seen him on the show in 3 years. So, you know, we've done what we can do. It wasn't a lot of grandstanding or self-congratulation. We just sort of put him out to pasture. I don't know what we can do beyond that, but, I mean, Hari Kondabolu has sort of made a career criticizing this character, I think his next documentary, he should criticize Hillary Clinton campaign ads. Oh, we're so sick of seeing those on TV all the time.
Yeah, so, and also more recently, just within the last few months, Hank Azaria said that he doesn't want to voice the character anymore.
Yeah, again, he's running up against this criticism, but he knows as well as anyone, he hasn't done Apu in 3 years.
Okay, so yeah, it's kind of a non-issue in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, we can't undo the past. And I've got to say, for 20 years, I would only hear from Indians, and I would ask the question. I was always curious about it. I go, are you offended by Apu? For 20 years, I would hear the answer, he's the only Indian on television. People were very happy to be represented. And I think, I know, every time this is in the paper, someone complaining about it, there's a raft of letters from Indians saying, I like Apu. I like him. He talks like my father. Or, I like Apu. He's a stereotype, but so is everyone on The Simpsons. I don't know why we should get a free ride. So it's not a cut and dried issue. I definitely agree it's offending some people, but I don't know how many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how many is too many? How many do you have to offend?
I think we should end this interview with a tag. I love The Simpsons. Okay. Do you have an idea for a tag that we can go out on?
Oh, you can't afford me. No, I mean, that's actual writing.
Yeah, but you're so witty just off the top of your head, nothing?
No, everybody should buy the book, buy okay. Springfield Confidential. Okay. First we have a commercial, then we have
yeah,
the
yeah.
tag.
We'll put a commercial in here, and then we'll come back and play your little tag about buying the book.
You should buy the book, and if you're too cheap to buy the book, and God knows I am, follow me on Twitter. If you follow me on Twitter, at Mike Reese Writer, I give you one good joke a day, just like the Jimmy Fallon show.
Mike Reese is the author of Springfield Confidential, Jokes, Secrets, and Outright Lies from a Lifetime Writing for The Simpsons. You can find out more about Mike at WPR.org/beta. And let us know your comments, questions, and maybe even your favorite Simpsons joke by sending a note to beta@WPR.org.